Well, could we turn then, please, to Judges chapter 9. We have to look at two people, Abimelech and Jephthah. Abimelech was not a judge. He was an ambitious upstart who, to put it frankly, got what he deserved. The story starts with the final few verses of chapter 8. Abimelech really belongs to the Gideon story. He's not at all connected with the Jephthah story. As we heard this morning, Gideon, in his declining years, wasn't the leader that he had been previously. Among the silly things he did was to accrue to himself many women, and this, of course, produced many children. 70 sons, we're told, he is credited with, and Abimelech is one of them. It appears from the final few verses of chapter 8 that Abimelech's mother was a Shechemite, but not necessarily an Israelite Shechemite. A Shechemite is a person who lives in Shechem. But there are two types of people who live in Shechem. There are the Israelites who have taken over the place, but there were also original inhabitants of Shechem whose association with Israel goes way back to the time of Jacob, referred to in the Genesis chapters 30 through that section. And I get the impression as I read these few verses that this particular woman was one of the local inhabitants, and that accounts for various features that crop up in the story. Gideon dies. Abimelech now decides that he would like to be the leader. And so he goes now in chapter 9, verse 1, to the people of Shechem. And he plays upon their prejudices, cronyism, I think we call it today, family loyalties, devotion to the clique, the in-group, that sort of thing. And he says to these chaps in verse 2, "What is better for you, that all 70 of the sons of Gideon," Gideon incidentally is Jerubbaal, "that all 70 rule over you, or that only one rule over you?" And there's no price for guessing who the one is that he has in mind. "After all," he says in the final sentence of verse 2, "remember, I am bone, your bone and your flesh. I'm related to you in a special way." And that is a pretty base sort of an appeal to make. But there's one thing that's been a fair nuisance in politics, in the church, in general. It's this appeal to self-interest, what you're going to get out of it, and this loyalty to the clique, cronyism, loyalty to the group, rather than loyalty to what is right. Happens a lot in churches, where people have a greater sense of devotion to their friends, relatives, family, etc., than they have really to doing what is right. And so often when the crunch comes, you find that ultimately they go with their friends rather than going with what is right. Now, they may not necessarily be in conflict, but sometimes they are in conflict. And people so often will appeal to our self-interest. Now, you think of a few chapters further on in the book of Samuel, where Saul was having conflict with David. He was after David's skin. And on one occasion he says to Jonathan, his son, "Look, why are you so friendly with this character, David?" He said, "Don't you know, as long as David's around, you are never likely to be king." You see, he's appealing to Jonathan's self-interest. But thankfully, Jonathan was a better man than that. And Jonathan says, "Well, he's a better man. If David is a better man, well, okay, let him be king. I'm quite happy to serve under him." Saul couldn't understand that sort of thinking. Later on, you find, as he's speaking to his fellow Benjaminites, remember Saul was from the tribe of Benjamin, and as they are chasing David through the scrub, he is trying to egg his Benjaminite friends on, and he said, "Look, you've got to get rid of this character David, because if he becomes king, all the top jobs will go to the fellows from his own tribe. He won't give them to you, he'll give them to the fellows from Judah. Now your fellows from Benjamin, and I've given you the top jobs. Now you better make sure that you're loyal to me and my group." These inter-tribal jealousies. This is the sort of thing that's happening here. It's this appeal to the clique, to the self-interest, inter-city jealousies or whatever it happens to be. And it works. It's amazing how often it works. It's wrong, but it works, unfortunately. And in verse 3, you find that when Abimelech had made that base appeal to the lower motives, they responded and they said, oh yes, after all he is our brother, so let's join forces. Whereupon Abimelech then proceeded to kill off the rest of his brothers so that he had no potential rivals to his leadership. He then established what he called a kingdom. These fellows have rather good imaginations at times. His kingdom, I'm sure, didn't extend very far outside Shechem. But it's the old story, you see. Here's a man who wants to be a big fish in a little pool. And they create an awful lot of trouble, people like that. They create trouble in churches, where they'll get around them a few cronies, and then they'll get themselves a position with exalted title, perhaps, and they can be a big man and throw their weight around, even though their kingdom only extends a very short distance. Well, one of the sons managed to escape, a chap called Jotham. And so in verse 7, you find that Jotham then goes and stands on the hill of Gerizim, which was on one side of Shechem, and he calls out to the people, he tells a story. It's a parable of some trees, and it goes roughly like this. The various trees of the forest went to a particular tree and said, "Reign over us." They went to the olive tree, and the olive tree says, "No, I've got more important things to do, such as giving people fruit and sustenance." And so they tried the fig tree, and the fig tree says, "Look, I'm not interested in the political manipulations of the place. I've got more important things to do, such as providing people with food and nourishment." They go to the grapevine, same response. Eventually they come to the bramble, just what the bramble wanted. He can't do anything. He doesn't provide fruit. He doesn't provide shade. He doesn't provide timber. All the bramble can do is provide a potential bushfire. He can easily get caught on fire and burn down the whole forest. And so said Jotham, this is what's happening here in Shechem. Noble men, honourable men, have more important things to do than simply seek power so that they can wield it over others. They're too concerned with serving people. And when you read the New Testament, isn't that what Jesus was talking about? That the way to greatness in his kingdom is through service. And too many people are more concerned with climbing this ladder, pulling the right strings, getting to know the right people, and somehow angling for that power-broking position that they're after. Here he reminds us that great men, just like great trees, are more concerned with giving useful service to their fellows than with seeking power for its own sake. The bramble, by contrast, that's what it wants. But what will the bramble do? Well, of course, it can provide nothing, but it can catch on fire and burn up the whole forest. Now, that's what's happening in Shechem. They've bought themselves a problem by getting Abimelech in charge of them. And eventually, says Jotham, Abimelech, that you've put in charge of you, will be the cause of your own destruction. And so often, foolish mistakes that people make in their fleshly attitudes ultimately bring doom and judgment upon their own heads. It's amazing how often we work out our own judgment through our own stupidity. Here's the case of it here in the case of the Shechemites. Well, you read the story on and you find it's not very long before trouble starts to brew. Not everybody likes Abimelech, and so they stir up some anti-Abimelech characters around the place. Then there's a plot to get rid of him. But unfortunately, one of the persons who's in on the plot leaks the message to Abimelech. And so Abimelech now comes and he's going to destroy these plotters against him, which he does very effectively. But now he gets burnt up. His pride has been hurt. His authority has been challenged. And that has really started him off. And there's nothing that's so devastating as hurt pride. A person's pride has been offended. And sometimes, of course, we'll make out that we're defending some moral principle or something that sounds very lofty, but if we're honest with ourselves, I think very often it's something a little baser than that. It's this horrible thing that we all have a fair dose of, and we have to work hard at keeping under control, and that's this thing of pride. And when it gets hurt, you never know what it's going to lead a person to do. And here we find what it leads Abimelech to do. He's been offended. His pride's been challenged. His authority is at risk. He's going to teach these fellows a lesson properly. So he gets rid of all the rebels. But he keeps on going then. He's red around the neck by now. His ears are pretty fiery and he's got his blood up. And so he decides he'll polish off all the people in Shechem. And then he can't stop there. He's got the taste of blood. And so he goes to one or two of the villages round about. And now he's just driven on in this senseless fury. It's rampaging through one place after the other. Crazy. The man just seems to go berserk. But you see, that's what happens, isn't it? That's what happens when pride takes over and we come to the defense of ourselves with great zeal and one thing leads to another and the whole thing gets out of hand. Well, the story ends with Abimelech getting a brick dropped on his head and that finished him off. He was attacking one town too many. and people took refuge in the tower. A lady had taken up to the tower a millstone, which she dropped over onto his head as he was coming to put some trees around to burn the place down. He didn't die on the spot, but he realised that he was a goner, and so he said to his armour bearer, "Thrust me through yourself. I'd hate to think that I died by the hand of a woman." That's the final evidence of pride. Masculine pride's been hurt well and truly now. That's even more dangerous than ordinary pride. Okay, we come to chapter 10, and that's the main subject that we have to look at, the judge Jephthah. The first five verses discuss two of the lesser-known judges that weren't in my brief, and so I'm not going to discuss them. They seem to be more concerned with civil administration. We come now to verse 6. The people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. They served the Baals and the Ashtaroth, and notice now the gods of the different nations. The gods of Syria, the gods of Sidon, that's up in Lebanon, the gods of Moab, and the gods of the Ammonites. The Moabites' god was Chemosh, the Ammonites' god was Molech, both of them referred to a number of times in the Old Testament. Also, in both cases, you find that child sacrifices were offered to both Chemosh and Molech. Scattered through the books of Samuel and Kings, you'll find references to that. That's the gods of the Moabites and the gods of the Ammonites. The Moabites and the Ammonites were related peoples. They were descended from Lot, from Lot's incestuous relationship with his two daughters. So they were related in some fashion to the Israelites. That's the origins of the Ammonites and Moabites. You can see where they live, down here to the east and south of Israel. Well, they served those gods, plus the gods of the Philistines in verse 6. You come down to verse 7. God is angry, and so he lets the Philistines and the Ammonites oppress them. The remainder of the book, except for the last few chapters, which is something of an appendix, the remainder of the book is concerned with these two oppressions. Now, we're going to deal with the Ammonites first, and then the Philistines is dealt with from chapter 13 onwards. And I think the reason the Philistines come at the end of the book is because that continues on. Most of these other oppressions, from Midianites, Ammonites, and so on, they more or less run their course by the time we finish the book. But the Philistines runs on through Samuel, through the reign of Saul, and it's not until you get to the time of David that they are eventually got rid of. But as we were reminded last night, Samson's job was to begin the job of overthrowing the Philistines. So the Philistines and the Ammonites possibly were involved in the same general period of time, but in different parts of the country. That's in verse 7. Halfway through verse 7, it says that, this is verse 8 now, for 18 years the Ammonites oppressed all the people who were beyond the Jordan in the land of the Amorites, which is Gilead. Now that gives us our setting. If you just look at the map here, Gilead, I mentioned before, was the major family in the tribe of Gad, and in popular terminology, Gilead simply meant east of Jordan, predominantly the tribe of Gad. That land previously had been taken from the Amorites. Notice in verse 8, the Amorites. If you cast your mind back to the stories of Moses, when Moses was leading the people through, prior to their entrance into Canaan, they conquered all that land through there, on the other side of the river. Zion, S-I-H-O-N, and Og were the two kings of the Amorites whose land they conquered. And then all that land east of the river was divided between those two and a half tribes. Moses died, and then later on Joshua led the people in to conquer Canaan, and then divided Canaan between nine and a half tribes. The Amorites, in general usage, simply refers to the Canaanites. In popular terminology, the two expressions were more or less interchangeable, and they were all under the ban. They were all under God's judgment. This land was taken from the Amorites, and it's an important point because it's going to crop up later in the story. That's in verse 8. For 18 years they oppressed the people of Israel who were beyond the Jordan. The man who writes this book is sitting somewhere here in the middle of Canaan. Beyond Jordan means the other side of the river over there on the east in the land of Gilead. Notice verse 9 that the Ammonites crossed the Jordan to fight also against Judah and Benjamin and Ephraim. So you can see what happens here. They come across the Jordan and they attack around this area. There's Judah, Benjamin and Ephraim. So they not only have taken control of the east, but spread over into the west as well. Well, the people of Israel cry out to the Lord after their 18 years of troubles. It's the old story that we've seen several times through the book. They're called upon then to get rid of their idols, they repent, they turn to God, they confess their sin, they surrender their idols, and promise to do better in the future. God then raises up a deliverer who is then going to lead them and overthrow the enemy and give them independence once again. Who then is going to be the leader? That's the next question. We come down to verse 17. The Ammonites were called to arms. Now the reason seems to have been that they must have sensed a feeling of rebellion among these people. For 18 years they had sat on top of them, and the people of Israel had more or less knuckled under. But now there was a stirring among the people of Israel, and so the Ammonites mobilized their forces. The whole of this story virtually is going to take place east of Jordan in this Gilead territory. Oh yes, there it is in verse 17. Again, they encamped in Gilead. And the people of Israel, they encamped in Mizpah, which is again on that side of the river. Verse 18, the leaders of Gilead then say to one another, who's going to fight with us? Who's going to lead us to fight against the Ammonites? And in chapter 11, verse 1, the man they find is Jephthah the Gileadite. Just by way of coincidence, in verse 1, Jephthah's father was also named Gilead. That's just to confuse you. The name of the place happens to coincide with the name of the man who was his father. That's a sheer fluke. There's a book up on the table there by Donald English, who happens also to be an Englishman. Just a fluke that English happens to be English. Well, so Gilead here was the name of his father, but it's also the name of the clan and the general region. Jephthah, we are told in verse 1, was the son of a prostitute. In verse 2, he was thrown out of the house by his brothers. You see that in verse 2. They said, you shall not inherit in our father's house because you're the son of another woman, and not a very nice woman. And so Jephthah gets thrown out. And Jephthah grows up tough and hard. Not the sort that you find around the aristocratic regions, drinking out of the best china and dressing in finery. He was a rough character. In verse 3 we are told that he joined a gang of bandits and he lived out in the sticks, raiding and plundering a general highway robber. Worthless fellows in my rather respectable version they are called. In some of your other versions they might be called something less charitable, but these worthless fellows gather around Jephthah, and so he becomes the leader of a gang of bandits. And he's just the boy they decide they want to lead them against the Ammonites. Often reminds me of Jomo Kenyatta, this fellow. When we were at school, we all learnt about the Mau Mau terrorists, who were pretty bad people butchering up the British and other people they didn't like in Kenya. And the leader of these was Jomo Kenyatta. And blow me down, who finishes up top of the stack when Kenya gets independent? None other than our friend Jomo Kenyatta. And contrary to so many expectations, he turned out to be not a bad leader after all. Now this man here, I mean, you wouldn't expect that the person you want for Prime Minister or President is a person who's leading a gang of bandits around the countryside. But Jephthah is the one they choose. But Jephthah is not one who's going to be pushed around. Oh yes, Jephthah will be their leader. But he's going to strike a bargain with them. He says, don't think that you can pull me out of the bush where I live and bring me in here to fight your battles and win you independence, and then when I've done the job you throw me out again. I'll fight for you, I'll lead you, but when we've won the victory, I become your leader, Prime Minister, call him what you like. Okay, they said, it's a deal. That's verse 9. And so now the action starts. First of all, you have some discussion, some parleying going on between the two sides in verse 12. Jephthah sends some messengers to the Ammonites and he says, now why have you come against me? That you have come to fight against me. Well, the king of the Ammonites in verse 13 said, because Israel, when it came out of Egypt, took away my land from the Arnon to the Jabbok to the Jordan, now therefore give it back peacefully. Actually, the Ammonites had already squatted on it anyway. But you see, it was an excuse. And so that was the excuse the Ammonites needed now to really put these Israelites in place. And from there on, down through the next dozen or 15 or 20 verses, we have a record of Jephthah's response. Now I'm just going to summarise it for you. It's fairly complicated, but once you've got the simple history and geography worked out, it's straightforward. The thrust of Jephthah's reply is this. You chaps are coming to me and saying you're going to take back the land that we took from you. Well, says Jephthah, we never took it from you in the first place. When Moses and his chaps came through, they did not take the land from the Ammonites nor from the Moabites. Now, maybe it was true many centuries ago the Ammonites and the Moabites did in fact occupy this land, but we didn't take it from you. Long before we arrived on the scene, the Amorites, A-M-O-R, the Amorites, had already moved right through, and they'd driven the Ammonites and the Moabites out. And when we took it from the Amorites, people who were already under God's judgment. We didn't take it from the Ammonites or the Moabites. In fact, God had given strict instructions to Moses that they were not to tamper with the Ammonites and the Moabites because they were related peoples. It was the people of Canaan, the Canaanites and the Amorites, who were under God's judgment, not the Moabites and Ammonites. And so, says Jephthah, we took it from the Amorites, not from the Ammonites. Secondly, he says, the land was given us by Jehovah our God, and that means it is ours for keeps. I think you'll find in verse 21, for example, he mentions Zion, the king of the Amorites. Israel took possession of all the land of the Amorites. Verse 22, they took possession of all the territory of the Amorites. Verse 23, so the Lord, the God of Israel, dispossessed the Amorites before the people of Israel. So there are the two main points. We took it from the Amorites, not from you folk at all, so you've got no bone to pick with us. Secondly, it was given us by Jehovah, and so as far as we're concerned, that's the end of the argument. And just finally, the Moabite king of the time didn't raise any objection. Why now should you people come and want it for yourselves? So says Jephthah, push off. I'm not going to debate the matter further. The result was, of course, that war followed. Jephthah then makes his vow. It's a rather foolish vow. He decides that he might try and buy God's support by promising God that whatever appears out of his door after he comes back victorious, he'll offer it to God. Maybe that will be a way of making sure that God gives him victory. As God says in one of the Psalms, I don't really need your sacrifices in that sense that you have to buy any favours from me. I already own them. I already own all the cattle and all the animals around the place and all the people and all the trees as well. So don't think that you're going to enrich me in somehow by offering me a prize. But Jephthah, remember, was not a theologian. He went to battle, they won, and as you read the story through, it seems quite clear that what he did was kept his vow. He was a tough fellow, and tough fellows like Jephthah don't go back in their word, and so he sacrificed his daughter, which was the sort of thing they were doing anyway, because it had already, we've already been told in chapter 10 that they were following the ways of the gods of the Moabites and the Ammonites, and child sacrifice was part and parcel of the Moabite and Ammonite religions. And so you can see that it was just one of those things he did. Now this, of course, raises a difficulty for us, because Jephthah is commended as a man of faith in Hebrews chapter 11. Well, fair enough. He is commended for his faith. But remember that he is only a very recently reformed bandit, and he knows very, very little of God, and his ideas are still certainly very coloured. But God never accepts us on the basis of our knowledge. The basis on which God accepts us is the basis of faith. And Jephthah had enough faith to come to God and ask him for help. Now, it doesn't mean to say that every one of his beliefs was correct. As the man in Hebrews chapter 11 says, faith is the fundamental issue. Without faith, it's impossible to please God. But the very fact that a person has faith doesn't mean to say that everything else in his life is thereby perfect. Even Abraham, the great example of faith, you read Abraham's life and you find that he did a few wrong things with women and deceit and various other misdemeanors that he was guilty of. But he had faith, you see. God accepts people not on the basis of their understanding of theology or their understanding of the workings of the Trinity or all these things. These things are helpful and they're necessary and they help us to grow as Christians, but the basis on which we're first accepted and that God is always looking for is the basis of faith, simply coming in trust. Jephthah had that trust, and for that he's commended. But as I say, he's only just recently been plucked out of the jungle, and he certainly needs a little bit of cleaning up in his theology and understanding of God if he's really going to be the godly leader he ought to be. The New Testament says the same. A person not a novice, you don't put a novice in charge of a church. He's got faith, he's a Christian, okay, but he's got to learn a lot of things yet before he really is going to be a godly leader. You come now to chapter 12, and after the battle, we find that the The people of Ephraim now pick a fight with Jephthah. We're just going to stop here and go back a shade to pick up a few threads concerning the people of Ephraim. They are the whingers, I suppose, would be the best way of describing them. They're the whingers among the tribes of Israel. If you go back and follow the history of these various tribes, you find they've all got distinctive characteristics, just like we think of Australians and Scotchmen and Irishmen and Americans as having different characteristics according to their nationalities and so forth. Likewise, among the tribes of Israel, you find considerable differences among different tribal groups. There was always a fair amount of tension between the Joseph tribes and the Judah tribe. Joseph, you'll recall, got the firstborn's blessing in place of Reuben, which meant that Joseph got two tribes, whereas all the other sons only got one. So there is no single Joseph tribe. There are in fact two Joseph tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh, named after his two sons. And all the way through, the history of Israel is really a tussle between the Joseph section and the Judah section. The Joseph section is what we're concerned with here, the two tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh. If you went back to the story of Joshua, you'd already find the seeds of this tension developing. And as it goes on through Judges and Samuel, it gets worse and worse. Of course, when you get the kings, the whole thing busts apart. And so the north, led by the Joseph tribes, breaks away from the south, led by Judah. If you went back to Joshua, you'd find that even at the time that Joshua was dividing up the land among the tribes, the two tribes that most complained that they didn't get a fair deal were Ephraim and Manasseh. And this element of whinging and complaining, it's not fair, we're not getting the best deal, that is very consistent, particularly among the people of Ephraim, who in the long run will turn out to be the most dominant tribe of the northern sector. When we come to Judges, it continues. If you just flip back, for example, to chapter 7, the story of Gideon. Remember, as we had earlier, Gideon had these men, 300 men, that created this enormous disturbance in the camp and led ultimately to victory. Well, that's in chapter 7 of Judges. It's referred to in verse 22 when they blew the 300 trumpets and so forth and so on. Then in verse 23, you have the men of Israel being called out from the other tribes as well, Naphtali, Asher, Manasseh, and so they now pursue after Midian. It's what I said this morning, that time and again through these stories, you'll notice that the spectacular event that we're more familiar with is really only the start. And Gideon's 300 men, that was the start, but now we find in verse 23 that the rest of the troops are mobilized, and so they all join now in the main attack. And in verse 24, the Ephraimites get a special job to do. Gideon sends the Ephraimites down to the Jordan River and says, cut off their escape route. Cut off the Midianites' escape route. Just to look at the map and get our bearings again. Gideon, you'll remember, is from the tribe of Manasseh, and the area that these Midianites had controlled was largely the central area. When Gideon's 300 stir them and they all take off, and then the larger body of Israelite forces from these various other tribes joins in and sweeps down upon them, the Midianites go scampering down to the fords of Jordan. The Ephraimites, here's the Ephraimites, they've got to go across there and seize the fords of Jordan to stop the Midianites getting away. That's in verse 24. Which they do, and in the process they manage to kill Oreb and Zeb in verse 25, Oreb and Zeb, who were two of the leaders of the Midianites. But in chapter 8, verse 1, when Gideon arrives on the scene, incidentally what Gideon was on about, he was chasing these fellows. These Midianites had escaped across the river, some of them anyway. Some of them had got killed by the Ephraimites who had seized the fords, but Gideon intended to follow them. He was actually after the real leaders, the kings themselves. When he gets down to the crossing at the river there, the Ephraimites have a complaint in chapter 8, verse 1. The men of Ephraim said to him, what is this that you've done to us? Why didn't you call us to go and fight with Midian? Why didn't you call us to the big battle? You give us this sort of leftover job of picking off a few soldiers as they're getting across the creek. We want the real action. We wanted to be there with all the blood and thunder stuff. And instead, you just give us this job down here. And Gideon is he's a fairly diplomatic character, and he has a very smooth way of answering them in verse 2. He says, what have I done in comparison with you? I mean, look at all the fellows that I have knocked off. hundreds of them, thousands of them, but just privates. You know, Private Jones, Private Zoreb, and Private someone else. Just the riffraff, infantrymen, you know, just odd bods. Oh, admittedly, I killed thousands of them, but they were all just the rank and file soldiers. But who have you killed? The two princes. The real top notches. So in verse 3 he says, God has given into your hands the princes of the Midian, Oreb and Zeb. What have I been able to do in comparison with you? And when they heard that, it says in the end of verse 3, their anger was abated. They rather liked that reply. That sort of suited them. And so they thought, yes, we're not that bad after all, are we? Really, we did get those. Thanks very much, Gideon. And so Gideon goes on his way rejoicing, and he's calmed his fellows down. It's the old proverb, a soft answer turns away wrath sometimes. And on this occasion, it did. It turned away the wrath of these fellows. And so the Ephraimites were happy. Incidentally, you notice again it was an appeal to pride, appeal to self-interest. It's the same principle we saw at the beginning. It's very common. We're all suckers for it, aren't we, at times? The very same sort of thing, when someone says something nice, we do tend to think we weren't that bad after all, were we? And so the old tendency of the sinful human nature, the flesh, it's there all the time to respond to that sort of flattery. We come now to chapter 12. And once again, the fords of Jordan come into the action. In verse 1, the men of Ephraim, you see the Ephraim people once again, they were called to arms and they crossed over to Zaphon and they said to Jephthah, why did you cross over to fight against the Ammonites? Why didn't you call us to the battle? Exactly the same thing. It's a different generation, but the same characteristic is there. Why weren't we in on the action? I mean, after all, we're the senior tribe. We're all the tough fellows around here. We're the leading tribe among the northern people. Why weren't we in on the action? And then they said at the end of verse 1, we'll burn your house over you with fire. Now, that's not the way you speak to Jephthah. You might get away with that sort of talk with Gideon, but not with Jephthah. He's not used to that. And so Jephthah in verse 2, he says, now listen, you fellows, I don't want any of that sort of talk. We've had a problem with all these Ammonites for the last 18 years. And he says, you sat up there, you haven't stirred yourselves. And so when you wouldn't get off your behinds and do something, we got stuck into it and I went in there and I risked my own life and we did this. Push off, I don't want to hear all your complaints. Well, that's verses 2 and 3. In fact, Jephthah decided he'd teach them a lesson. He wasn't to be trifled with, was this man Jephthah. You see, he had been brought up out in the tough. He was an embittered, hard character. Not the rather softly spoken, diplomatic type that Gideon was. Gideon had been brought up on his texts, a soft answer turneth away wrath or whatever. But where Jephthah lived out in the rocks and the caves, there were no, golden gleanings calendar with your verse for the day out there to tell him what to do. And so Jephthah, choice gleanings, yeah. You see, Jephthah wasn't being trifled with. And in verse 4, Jephthah then gathers all the men of Gilead and they fight against the Ephraimites. And they give the Ephraimites a real caning. Now the Ephraimites haven't got much answer to this except to call them dirty names in the end of verse 4. And so the Ephraimites call the Gileadites fugitives, you Gileadites, scaredy cats, you've run away, you're cowards, because after all, this is where the real Israelites live, in Canaan, proper Israelites. You people on the other side of the river, second-class citizens, you Gileadites, you sort of run away from Israel, you live over there like half Israelites and half something else. Name-calling, pretty pathetic, isn't it, really? And yet, you know, that's exactly what happens. It happens among Christians, that same sort of thing. That when rational discussion gets nowhere, then people resort to name-calling. It only needs one name sometimes. Just a few words, just enough to smear him. And once you've smeared him, it's around, and then that's the end, and you've done the dirty work. Maybe totally untrue. He believes in falling away doctrine. That's all you need to say. Or he's a tribulationist, or he's a Calvinist, or an Arminian, or whatever particular theological swear word you've got. And just smear him. But that's what happens. And one sentence, one word, said in the right context, and the poor chap then carries around some sort of big question mark over him. It may be true, it may not be true. But it's the dirty way it's done. And that's precisely what these people resorted to. When they found that they had no other leg to stand on, they resorted to name-calling. Well, we find pretty soon that the ones who are really running away are not the people of Jephthah, but the people of Ephraim. So, of course, in verse 5 now, the Gileadites, that's Jephthah's troops, they go down and take the fords of Jordan against the Ephraimites. You see what's happening here? Just look at the map, you'll see it all works out. Ephraim lives here. They have crossed the river. They've crossed the river and they've talked to Jephthah in rather uncharitable terms. And Jephthah has responded in equally uncharitable terms, and he's started to chase them. So all these Ephraimite people now, they're on the run, and they're screaming back to get back home. Well, Jephthah's right in their tail, so he comes down here and he sends some of his boys down to the Jordan to cut off the Ephraimites' escape route. And then the Ephraimites get picked off as they go. They tried to disguise themselves and make out they weren't Ephraimites, but they had their own particular accent, and that, of course, gave them away. Just like a lot of Kiwis and Australians, these Kiwis trying to make out their Aussies, and so you get them down and just make them say something like, sex, right, fish and chips in the bin, I will kill you if you... And you pretty soon work out who's what. Now, that's what they did. And so the Ephraimites came to grief. They can see from that how it hangs together in relation to that map there. The fords of Jordan. It's interesting, isn't it? Just one of those little quirks of history. The chickens have come home to roost, well and truly, as far as the Ephraimites are concerned. They always do come home to roost, you know. We hate to think of it, but it's true. It's not in the Bible, incidentally, that quote, but the principle is there. What you sow, you reap. And eventually, the dirty tricks come home, one way or the other. Going back to the previous story, it was the fords of Jordan that they were complaining about. Remember? Why did you only give us this tin pot job to do down at the fords of Jordan? And they wish the fords of Jordan never existed now. They're back at the fords of Jordan, and that's the end of them. Sobering message, I find it so anyway. Well, the story concludes with the people of Jephthah killing off these Ephraimites. I think that was quite uncalled for. In verse 6, they killed these Ephraimites. There's no need for that. They had to maybe kill off the Ammonites, the invaders, but these are their own kith and kin. But you see, once again, what happens? People don't know when to stop. It's the old Abimelech story back again. Abimelech didn't know when to stop. Once the anger got building up inside him, blind rage, hurt pride just drove him on. And now the same thing's happened with Jephthah and his fellows. They've got this, you insult us like that, and so now they just go berserk. And they massacre fellows from one of the other tribes down there at the fords of Jordan. Well, that's the end of the story. And I trust there might have been one or two points in that section tonight that will perhaps be a warning to us and a very down-to-earth exposure from the Word of God of some of the weaknesses of human nature and some of the things we ought to take notice of. Just to wrap up the story of Jephthah, incidentally, we find in verse 7 that he ruled for 6 years. Apparently nothing exciting happened because nothing is recorded, and then he died. Perhaps prematurely, we're not sure. But I gather that he must have made a reasonable fist of his governorship for those few years.